Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll try to take up this question, and certainly it's a question that we've discussed before on this program. Can the United States meet its need for energy and at the same time meet the challenge of global climate change? We have two guests here with us in the studio who have done a lot of thinking about and work in this area, Christine Irvin and Paul Portney. They are here to take part in an event that's sponsored in part by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois. This is the sixth annual Craig Bazzani Lecture in Public Affairs. It's free and open to the public, begins this afternoon at 4, and this takes place in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute at 400 North Matthews. That's in Urbana. Our two guests are Paul Portney and also Christine Irvin. Paul Portney, he's been at the University of Arizona since he served as president and chief executive officer of the group Resources for the Future. That is a nonpartisan research organization specializing in environment and energy issues. He also served as chief economist for the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Before she started her own consulting company, Christine Irvin was the first president and chief executive officer of the Green Building Council. She was also appointed by President Clinton in 1993 to serve as U.S. Assistant Secretary of Energy in charge of investments in energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies. They are here to take part in this event, and we're very pleased that they could be here with us in the studio to talk about some of these same issues. Now, of course, people are interested. They can go and hear them speak this afternoon, but here on the program, they are open to your questions, as we are always. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. Well, thank you both very much for being here.
Our pleasure.
We appreciate it. Let me begin just with a kind of a general question. It seems that as we talk about how, as a matter of policy, we want to approach the subject of dealing with climate change, it seems that we are often presented with two approaches that are seen to be sort of mutually exclusive. One is the sort of the market-based approach, and the other is the regulatory approach. And the regulatory approach basically says government passes laws, monitors compliance, and if there's not compliance, there's some kind of consequence. The market-based approach says something more like, well, maybe instead of expecting people to do the right thing because there'll be a penalty if they don't, we say, well, can we find some incentives so they will think, well, it's in their interest to do the right thing, not just because there's a penalty if they don't. And now, if you feel that I've done okay, at least in thumbnail sketching what the two approaches are, I guess my question is this. Does it have to be one or the other?
Well, you framed it perfectly well. And I think the answer is, at least from my point of view, is we need both. I mean, this is a big challenge. And we've got to essentially re-engineer our energy infrastructure in a short period of time. And so you need a combination. Regulatory, like building codes and appliance standards and fuel efficiency standards for cars. But we also need strong market-based programs like a cap-and-trade system and thinking about them together as well as complementary.
Mm-hmm. I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Resources for the Future, and when you were at Resources for the Future, you were really one of the people that advanced this idea of cap-and-trade.
That's correct, and I guess I would go back, David, to your original question and say that in a sense I think the differences are not so great as people might think. Mm-hmm. I don't know of anybody, of any responsible student of climate policy who would say that the government doesn't need to get involved in one form or another. So when you talk about a cap-and-trade system that would make the right to pollute much more expensive than it is now, or a carbon tax, which would be another way to do this, both of those are regulatory interventions. So the real question is, maybe there are some people who don't think that this is a problem and who just think that completely unregulated markets are okay, but I really don't think there are too many of those left. So the question is, what's the nature of the regulatory interventions? Does it take the form of implementing a cap-and-trade system or a carbon tax, although the latter seems unlikely? And does it include things like Christine mentioned, building standards or more traditional command and control type regulatory interventions?
Mm-hmm. Well, give me – maybe let's have an example of each one and how it can work. And perhaps because, Ms. Irvin, you have been so much involved in promoting standards for energy efficient buildings. You've been very much involved in the idea of green buildings and the LEED kind of standards that that we have started to hear more and more about. But we'll talk about that and talk about how that works.
The green building arena is a perfect example of the interplay that Paul was just referring to. Here you have the LEED green building rating standard that has become the de facto standard for green buildings in the country today. It's developed by a voluntary nonprofit organization called the U.S. Green Building Council. At the same time, the federal government played a huge role in helping launch the LEED program. The night that we launched LEED in the year 2000, the administrator for the General Services Administration stood up and said that every new federal building that GSA operates will be LEED Silver. So there the federal government played a role in a voluntary market-based program. And now we see, 8 years after it's been launched, that there is so much experience in the market and that we've tested so many different practices that that is now feeding into the floor of the expectations for buildings. So you have a voluntary program pushing the envelope at the upper end, and now it's time for building codes and standards to start building in what is now becoming common practice. So the two go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it makes perfect sense. It seems perfectly logical to say if you're thinking about building a building, then what you have to think of is not only what it costs you to build that building today, but what are your long-term operating costs? What will be the cost over the life of the building? And if you can do something today that will reduce your energy costs over the life of the building, it seems it's a proverbial no-brainer. Well, of course, you're going to do that. But is it necessary? So I suppose some people would say, well, the market-based approach says that people will want to do that just because it makes sense. You won't have to pass a rule that says you need to do that.
There are lots of obstacles in the market to doing what you would think makes a lot of sense otherwise. There are a lot of incentives for building green these days. That's certainly true. There are many companies, for example, that think that if you're putting up a non-green new building today, you've got an obsolescent product on the market already, and they think it's very short-sighted. That's an amazing flip in perspective within just a few years. But there are common and simple obstacles. For example, in many, many state budgets, many university budgets, you have funds appropriated in two different buckets, one for capital improvements and one for operating expenses. So there's no incentive or little incentive for a building to be based on a life cycle perspective if they don't get to keep the operational savings that would come from paying slightly more at the front end.
Mm-hmm. Well, just give me another example. I'm turning here to Paul Portney. Give me another example of something that works is a market-based strategy that really works. And again, here is say maybe this is something that's aimed at air quality or pollution or whatever it is. And maybe cap and trade is a good one.
Well, let me give you an example where we have gotten a lot of the kind of behavior that many people think we need to get more of without any government intervention at all. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting that we don't need it in other areas. When gasoline went up above $4 a gallon, demand for sport utility vehicles and other light-duty trucks fell through the floor, and people all of a sudden began to buy cars again, something that hadn't been happening for a long time. The government didn't do anything there. It was a response to the market. And one could argue, and this is a complicated analysis to try to do, one could argue that that response to a price signal has had a much bigger impact and will in the future on fuel economy in the United States than the government setting tighter fuel economy standards. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden the price of gasoline has started to slide back, and I was meeting on Monday with the vice presidents of several auto companies who said that already with prices having gone from $4 a gallon roughly back down to $3, that buyers on the lots were beginning to take a second look at SUVs and seemed maybe a little bit less motivated to buy smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. And for that reason, you may need either fuel economy standards propping up fuel economy from below, or, and I realize that this is heresy in an election year, a commitment on the part of the government to guarantee that gasoline would be at least $4 a gallon by increasing the excise tax as the market price for gasoline fell. So there's no question that regulation can play a role in this, but it's also the case that people respond pretty quickly to market signals, and especially market signals that they think are going to remain in place for a long time.
Well, it seems that the example you give, I think, for a long, long time, in response, if you pose the question, can we, what could we do or what could happen that would persuade people to drive less and perhaps drive more, want to have more fuel-efficient cars? And I think a lot of people would say, well, that's pretty simple. It has to do with the price of fuel. And you can see in other countries, other governments have taken different strategies. Certainly a lot of places pay a lot more for their gasoline than we do. So people have said, well, that's no big secret. Make gasoline more expensive, people will drive less and want it, and they want more fuel-efficient cars. And when the price of fuel went up, it happened just like that. And I suppose that some people would indeed say, well, why should we wait for the market to provide a price signal? I mean, why not, as a matter of government policy, say, well, then we're going to make gasoline more expensive. We're going to tax it. And as I say, I think there are a lot of places where that in fact, that is the strategy that they've used and it has been successful. I mean, is that simply something that we can't do because of political realities?
Well, it's difficult to do in an election year, that's for sure. It's arguable whether we could do it in a non-election year. And I cling to the hope, though there aren't many remaining with me, that once we recognize the budget difficulties that the country has in the long term, made more difficult by the recent financial bailout, that taxing gasoline as a way to provide revenue so that we don't have to increase income taxes or taxes on savings, that taxing gasoline and things that we want to discourage will be seen as something that both helps us deal with an environmental problem and also a fiscal problem. But trying to push that point in 2008 is a big challenge.
Yeah. We have a caller here. I want to make sure this person knows. I won't make them wait forever. But I want to come back to Christine Irvin and perhaps again ask a related point. I think that some people would suggest that also we could do much, much more in the required fuel economy standards that the government sets, and that they're pretty modest and that over time they have been increased. But the increases are quite modest. I'm sure that some people argue, oh, it should be much, much better. We ought to, you know, we ought to require 50 miles to the gallon, or, you know, whatever, you know, push, see how far we can push that technology. Why not do that? Why is it that we cannot raise those standards to a point that would really challenge the automakers and then make a big dent in our fuel consumption?
Well, I think we can and we should. And certainly that's in the agenda for Senator Barack Obama if he becomes president. And he is calling for a systematic regular increase in the fuel efficiency standards. So I think that is possible. You know, it is ironic, going back to Paul's statement, it is ironic in this country that so values the free market system that we don't take better advantage of it by using the price signal a little bit more. We do pay a high price for not getting prices to more accurately reflect full costs. If you think about how our urban structures or urban areas have developed on the basis of cheap gasoline, now we're compensating for that. In the city of Portland, where I live now, it was actually the first city in the country to develop a climate change action plan in the 90s, and they have already achieved their 1990 level target. Part of the reason is because they have a more dense form of development and have more walking, biking, mass transit opportunities to help compensate for that lower price of gasoline. It works.
Hmm. We have a couple of callers here. I want to bring them in, and also I'd like to introduce again our guests. Christine Irvin is president of Christine Irvin Company, her own consulting company based in Portland, Oregon. She was the first president and CEO of the Green Building Council and is a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Energy. Paul Portney is dean of the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona, Tucson, former president and CEO of Resources for the Future, former chief economist for the White House Council on Environmental Quality. They're both here to take part in a panel discussion on the subject, how can the U.S. and the world develop effective policies for dealing with global climate change? This is the Craig Bazzani Lecture in Public Affairs. It takes place this afternoon on the U of I campus. Anybody can attend. It's at 4 o'clock in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute on the campus. And here, questions are welcome, too. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. First up is someone in Champaign, and this is line one. Hello.
Thank you. My question goes to this issue of cap and trade, and forgive me if I'm a little hazy on the details of what I'm about to ask you about. I haven't had time to go back and research this. But I heard someone on energy policy on, I think it was last week, on Democracy Now!, who was skeptical about the efficacy of cap and trade and that whether or not it would really bring about the kind of reductions, and also that it was sort of a giveaway to these polluters. And he talked about a proposal, and apparently somebody has a bill somewhere buried in Congress, and I think he referred to it as a cap and a dividend. Or something to that effect, to some variation on that. The idea being that you would put a tax at the source on the producers of the carbon pollutants, and that you would then have each year, you know, sell them the ability to use this, you know, put this out there into the environment, and then reduce it by a certain percentage each year, and that the market would then drive the cost of these permits up because it become a more and more scarce resource, and then have the dividends from that, much like the Alaskan, gas or Alaskan oil goes back to the people of Alaska, have the dividends from this be distributed into the accounts of the citizens of the United States.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure, I'm happy to answer the question, which is a good one, and it actually mixes two issues related to cap and trade, and let me see if I can briefly spell them out. First of all, there's always skepticism about anything that the government proposes, but we have a very, very successful example of cap and trade in the United States in that in 1990, when Congress modified the Clean Air Act to require all existing coal-fired power plants to reduce their emissions. They gave everybody an emission reduction that had to be met, but gave the power plants the ability to meet that reduction by paying other plants to go even beyond what the other plants' initial goal was, so long as the combined emission reduction from both plants was equivalent to the starting point. And as a result of that first wide-scale application of cap and trade in the United States, sulfur dioxide emission reductions have proven to be greater than called for in the Act, have occurred on a faster than legislated schedule, and have cost even less than the proponents of cap and trade initially suggested. So we have a very successful national scale example of a cap and trade program having been put in place. Now, the second issue here is if we limit the amount that can take place, we have to issue permits. And so there's a big question under any cap and trade system about who gets the permits. Under Senator McCain's cap and trade proposal, which is almost identical to Senator Obama's proposal, we have two candidates with very similar positions on reducing emissions from coal-fired power plants. Under Senator McCain's proposals, he would give the permits away largely to existing emitters, and that's the approach that we took in 1990 when we were regulating sulfur dioxide. under Senator Obama's approach, he would auction off all the permits and in the process generate a large amount of revenue. So the difference between the two, even though they have fairly similar goals to their cap and trade proposals, has to do with whether the permits are given away at the start, thus lessening the burden on the power plants that have to make the emission reductions, because at least they're given something valuable in the process, which arguably would keep electric utility rates from going up as much as they would were the permits to be auctioned. As my possibly incoherent answer indicates, it's a very complicated subject. But I think that we have ample evidence that this can work in the United States, and this is the method that's been put in place in Europe as well.
Thank you.
All right, let's continue. We'll go to a caller here. This is someone in Urbana, line two. Hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? Mm-hmm. It's a nice subject, and it sounds good in the rhetorical sense. But if you read the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's reports that have been coming out for the last, let's say, 10 years, you'll see that emissions, planetary emissions of CO2, which CO2 is not a regional, it's a planetary problem, have increased. Europe, after Kyoto, their emissions have increased 30%, even though they have a lot of, you know, mass transit, and they have mostly nuclear in France. But and it's interesting to see how we sit around. I think we've, in my opinion, I mean, really pessimistic about this. I think we've sort of run out of time. And all the rhetoric, I mean, you're almost, it's like this financial crisis that's going on now. The attempt is to take all of the banking systems, which are worldwide, and unify their response to this. Now, whether that sticks or not is going to, you know, we'll find out in 6 months if we're all broke. But the thing is that it seems to me, I wrote a letter to the New York Times on the 15th of January in which they published in the science section about this issue, and it was about two paragraphs. And the simple statement is that we are not reducing emissions. We talk about reducing emissions. We set up all these programs, which are, if you look at them in the real term, are sort of irrelevant. We're just, in a sense, destroying the planet, but we can talk about not destroying the planet. And it's very frustrating to me to listen to these, I mean, all these meetings and all this trade and all these sort of schema, which basically, you know, and using market forces, like you said, gas is $4 a gallon. That was based mostly on speculation because demand has not really reduced that much. So it's funny that we just sit around. It's like we're just spinning our wheels, waiting for everybody just to die off. I just don't understand why, how anybody with a straight face can sit around and talk about this stuff as if like we have a lot of time left. I mean, parts per million of CO2 are almost nearly 400 parts per million. I mean, they're talking about catastrophes at 450, and it's accelerating, not decelerating.
Well, I take your point and your depth of feeling. Let's give the guests here a chance to respond.
Well, I definitely share your concern for urgency. We're paying a high price for waiting so long to take a strong position internationally and to set our own aggressive targets. So timing and urgency is clearly an issue. But there are some positive things to look at as well if we accelerate our actions quickly. And that is looking at California as an example. Through a strong set of policies, and that includes building codes and standards and a variety of other tools, California has held their per capita electricity emissions constant over the last 25 years, while the rest of the nation has gone up about 1 to 1.5% a year. There's plenty of evidence in various parts of the country that we can cut emissions if we put our minds to it. So I agree that it's urgent. We need to step up the action immediately. And that includes a strong international role as well in helping craft the post-Kyoto agreement so that we can work with other rapidly developing countries to help them leap over our existing technologies to the new low-carbon technologies.
And I would just add to what Christine has said that, and possibly contrary to the tone of the caller, that it's taken the United States and the world a long time to get into this fix, and we're not going to get out of this fix in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. We have to change the incentives that people face through regulatory action, whether it's building codes or fuel economy standards or cap and trade programs that price energy much more expensively than it is now. But if we do this gradually but in a determined way over the next 20 to 25 years, you're going to see a United States in which we have much more electricity conservation. At the margin, more and more of our electricity coming from wind and solar, although it's going to take a long time before either of those sources make a big difference. And quite importantly, you're going to see motor vehicle transportation powered more by plug-in hybrids, alternate fuels, and conceivably, even in my lifetime, the beginnings of significant penetration of hydrogen vehicles. And so anyone like the caller who thinks that we need to do something absolutely dramatic overnight, I think is destined to be disappointed. But I think a series of small and then increasingly significant steps over time will put the United States back in the leadership position that it ought to be in on this issue and on a trajectory that will leave a world for my children and my grandchildren that's more livable than it will be if we don't do anything.
Two additional comments. It's interesting that the caller drew the analogy to the financial crisis. I think it's a very good analogy. And in fact, just a few days ago, the president of the World Bank, Robert Zoellick, discussed the fact. In fact, his quote was, "One of the lessons of today's financial crisis is that you have to get ahead of these things." And so we do need to play catch up. The second comment, or we pay a price, as we have seen in the financial crisis. The other comment is that we need a dual track of actions. Too often we hear, and especially from the current administration, we hear a lot of emphasis on the need for breakthrough new emerging technologies. But there is a great deal that can be done with existing technologies. And if we were to greatly accelerate our progress, it would be to harvest the energy efficiency and resource productivity that we know how to do now, capture that, and then that provides more flexibility for taking advantage of some of the emerging technologies in the next 15 to 20 years.
Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Christine Irvin is president of Christine Irvin Company based in Portland, Oregon. She was the first president and CEO of the Green Building Council. She is also former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Energy. Paul Portney currently serves as dean of the Eller College of Management at University of Arizona in Tucson. He's former president and CEO of Resources for the Future. He's also a former chief economist with the White House Council on Environmental Quality. They're here to take part in a panel discussion on the question, how can the U.S. and the world develop effective policies for dealing with global climate change? This is the Craig Bazzani Lecture in Public Affairs. It's sponsored in part by the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois. It takes place this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute on the campus. Anyone's interested in anyone who's interested in stopping by is welcome. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that certainly a lot of people feel that if we're going to deal with this problem, what we've got to do, obviously, is get away from our reliance on fossil fuels and move to more green energy sources, things like wind and geothermal and what am I leaving out? Oh, solar. Yeah, how about that? And yet, one of the things we know is that these industries have been struggling for a long time to compete. And the question continues to come, well, okay, so what do we do about this? Do we directly intervene in some way to help them and give them a leg up? Or do we continue to insist on saying, well, you know, let the market have its way, and if they can compete, they will compete?
There's a lot that we can do. We need to think a lot bigger on the renewable energy technologies. One of the greatest handicaps in the U.S. To renewable energy technologies has been the inconstant, the very uncertain federal policy, particularly concerning the renewable energy tax credits. The CEO for General Electric told Congress 2 years ago that there is nothing more chilling to private investment than not knowing whether or not the federal government would extend those tax credits. So that has done a lot to create the up and down cycle, while other countries have greatly invested in renewable energy technologies. On the other side, we're seeing a tremendous amount of success with all of the technologies that you've mentioned, with the prices coming down dramatically. Oregon, which isn't particularly known for its ample amount of sunshine, is now expected to be the largest site of solar manufacturing in the country, based on about 7 or 8 different plants locating there right now, through, in part, the institution of some business energy tax credits. Google Corporation has come out with a very aggressive plan that they think is very feasible about getting to tenfold the amount of renewable energy technologies by 2030. The RAND Corporation believes we can get to 25% of all electricity by 2025, and many states have passed standards that are calling for that. So we can look forward to doing much more in the renewable energy technology field within the next 2 decades.
Hmm. What about do you think that there's any role for government in directly funding research and development rather than simply saying, well, we're going to do it through a tax credit way? Some people would say, look, let's just do it. Let's just spend the money.
Well, I do think that there's a role for government R&D. I don't think that there's any question about that, and I think we've spent too little in the past. When one thinks about this, the one thing that makes me a little bit nervous is that everybody says we need the government to do more, and we do need to recognize that on occasion the government jumps in, perhaps in a well-intentioned way, and does something wrong. And I think the most glaring example of that right now are the huge subsidies that exist for ethanol, which were done for reasons not having to do with climate science but rather political science. You know, it's actually the most notable thing that's been done in the United States in an effort supposedly to get away from petroleum and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And I don't think there are very many people now who don't think that this has been a debacle. But I definitely think that you can justify the subsidies for wind, geothermal, solar, and other renewables unless you were to say, we're just going to charge coal and natural gas in electricity generation and petroleum and transportation their full social costs. In other words, make them pay for the accumulations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere so that they're paying for all of the costs associated with their production and use, and we're going to completely level the field by doing away with all subsidies. Until and unless we do that, I think you can justify more government spending on R&D in renewables and alternative transportation fuels and technologies.
You have a strong second from Christine on that one.
Well, let's talk with another caller. Here's someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. Earlier on the show, you were talking about how the higher oil prices were impacting basically the sales of more fuel-efficient cars and how this basically impacts also the carbon emissions and everything down the lane. But I was kind of wondering, shouldn't there be a different policy in place to kind of, you know, regulate, no, not regulate, or incentives in place which kind of, you know, give better opportunities or more choice for public transport or for personal transport? Because, I mean, airplanes use a lot of oil and they are big polluters. And what about, like, you know, if the government steps forward and introduces a new program to strengthening travel by train, because this has been constantly declining in this country, but it would be so much more convenient. And this is all I want to say, or just to kind of step back from the personal travel, but increase public transport facilities to basically tackle the issue of carbon emissions via oil or petrol.
All right. Well, that's a good question. Can you say something about that?
Well, I would really second what we just talked about a minute ago. When you get the price right to reflect all social costs, then you're automatically doing a lot to take care of true mobility. And that is not just the ability to drive in your private vehicle, but your ability to take mass transit and walk and bike. In Portland, again, you know, the biking is six times the natural average per capita. And it's not as though they're being driven to bikes. It's convenient. It's an option for them to use. But until we get strong price signals that level the playing field, we're going to have to step in and institute a number of policies, incentives, and programs to provide mobility. I agree with the caller.
I do as well, and I would just note that when gasoline went to $4 a gallon, you began to see something that you hadn't seen in the United States for a long, long time, and that was increasing capacity or occupancy on buses, on trains, inner-city buses, et cetera. Christine made a point earlier on that I think is very important, and that is that this country has grown up spatially premised on very, very inexpensive gasoline so that people think nothing of driving a half an hour or 45 minutes to work each day. Those kinds of decisions are difficult to reverse in the short term. But if there's some predictability, for instance, that gasoline will remain expensive in the long term, then when it's time for someone to move, they will factor in the cost of driving into where it is they decide to live or where they look for a job, et cetera. The challenge is in trying to do a lot in a very, very short period of time because of the way infrastructure has developed in the United States.
Hmm. Well, you know, forgive me for belaboring this point, but I guess I continue to find myself thinking about the price signal sort of notion. And again, with this case of what happened in response to the increase in the price of oil and then gasoline. And we, you know, some people would argue, well, while it might have been extraordinarily painful for a lot of people, that there might actually have been some benefit if, in fact, people drove less, they moved to mass transit, they started thinking about more fuel-efficient cars. But that spike in the price of oil and the price of gasoline, we didn't do that intentionally. Nobody sat down and said, well, you know, this would be a good thing, so let's make this happen. It just happened. And now there's been some contraction. So we wonder whether, in fact, all these benefits that we've seen will start to creep back if gasoline is less expensive. I guess I'm still finding myself wanting to ask this question. Well, if we achieve this benefit by that price spike that we had no – it just happened for a variety of reasons. Well, why don't we adopt as a more matter of deliberate policy, why don't we do something to in a more permanent way jack up the price and so that we can have the intended benefit?
Well, as I said earlier, I think that's exactly what the United States needs to do, though fortunately I don't have to run an election for my job, and that's the challenge there. But let me say that while I mentioned earlier we've seen the price of gasoline falling back and we've seen some possible second thoughts on the part of consumers about whether they really do want to abandon big vehicles, I actually do think we've seen a dramatic change, and that change has come about in the car companies. I think what we used to call the big three, General Motors, Ford, and now Chrysler again, although it's owned by a private equity firm, rightly or wrongly, they have decided that high gasoline prices are something that the world is going to live with for a long time and have begun fairly dramatically retooling the kinds of cars that they purchase. And In effect, that is going to be a precondition of the $25 billion in loan guarantees that they recently got, was that this money is going to be will have to be used to produce more fuel-efficient vehicles. So even if the price of gasoline does fall back, which I think would be a lousy public policy, I think we're going to see cars in the future that will be much, much more fuel-efficient than what we've seen over the last 10 to 15 years.
Hmm. But just a little bit earlier when I was talking about the idea of alternatives to fossil fuels, I mentioned renewables, and there was one thing I didn't mention, it is hugely controversial, and that is nuclear generation. The people have there's a range of opinion on this. There are a lot of people who say if we're going to meet our need for electricity and reduce our emissions, we don't have much choice. There are other people who say, you know, that I don't care what you say. The downsides of this are very significant. And one thing we certainly know is that no nuclear plant has been undertaken here in the United States for a long time. And I guess I'm just interested in your opinions about nuclear power and whether in a sense, whether we like it or not, that's going to have to be a greater part of the mix of energy sources than it is now.
Well, unfortunately, I think it does have to be part of the portfolio because we've waited so long. That's a different point of view than I had 10 years ago. When I was director of the Oregon Department of Energy, we had a responsibility for overseeing a nuclear power plant in the state. That was my baptism into nuclear technology and politics and becoming familiar with the waste issue. And at that time and for a number of years since, I had a very clear point of view that until we have resolved the various safety issues associated with storage issues, the security issues associated with it, it should be off the table. But I think because we have waited so long to take concerted action on climate change and because the scale of this challenge is so big to decarbonize our energy infrastructure, I think it does have to be part of the mix. But we do need to focus strongly on two things. One, on resolving those various issues, security and disposal, transportation, and two, to not do it at the expense of the even higher priorities, and that is efficiency and renewable energy.
Hmm. And I agree. You simply cannot take nuclear off the table. If you look at the electricity generating mix in the United States today, it's roughly 50% coal, 20% natural gas, and 20% nuclear. Of the remaining 10%, hydro is about 7%. And so all of the things that we would like to play a bigger role in the future comprise only 3% of electricity generation today, and that's wind, geothermal, solar. We all think that that needs to grow, but we're going to need more and more electricity in the United States as this country grows, and I hope we continue to grow. And if that's to be the case, we need to have a nuclear presence just in case the cost of solar and wind and these other technologies doesn't come down as fast as we hope it can come down with the judicious use of government incentives.
And do you – so it, you say that today wind, geothermal, solar, those things together, their contribution is 3%?
About 3%.
About 3%. Mm-hmm. What do you think that it could be in – well, I don't know what kind of you can set the time frame, but what how much do you think that could be increased?
I think it could easily be with concerted action. Mm-hmm. We could realistically plan by 25% by 2025. Any number of states have set that goal. California has just increased theirs to 30%. So I think it's doable. The RAND Corporation study that I referred to believe that we could hit 25% by 25 with no real increase in the cost of energy if the cost of manufacturing of those technologies continues to decline for about over the years 20%. That's on track with the experience that we've already seen. Generally, there's a rule of thumb that with a doubling of manufacturing capacity, you see a 10% decrease in price. And that's what's been happening over the last 15 years, and I think we can continue to see that happening.
I'm a little bit less optimistic, I hope, for that goal. Remember, we could have 100% renewable electricity generation in the United States in 5 years, but electricity would cost 25 or 30 cents a kilowatt hour rather than 6 or 7 or 8 or something like that. So it's not a question of whether we can dramatically ramp it up. It's whether we can dramatically ramp it up at a price that people are willing to pay and which allows the technology enough time to come down in cost so that it's economically competitive.
We have about 5 minutes. We do have another caller here, someone I think in Watsika. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Back in about 1975, President Reagan canceled a program that produced electricity from a sun that we produced artificially, and it was done in two places, in Livermore, California at the research labs, and in Princeton at the research labs. And after he canceled it, you know, within days of both labs making nuclear fusion work, making a sun, very, very short duration of making the sun. But the European Union, or whatever it was at that time, was also working on it, and they continued their project. Can somebody look into this? That's about all I have to say.
All right. This is an experimental technology that says if you could – nuclear power plants use fission, but the sun works by fusion. So some people would say, well, if you could figure out the way essentially to do that and put it in a bottle, now there you'd have something. It is an extraordinarily complicated technology, and I don't know even if we went at this full bore how long it would take or if we could ever make it actually work. Is that something that you have some thoughts about or some experience thinking about?
It's a great question, but I'm just a broken-down economist and I don't understand the technology.
No, nuclear physicists here?
I'm not qualified to speak to it.
All right.
You know, and just taking a gander, I'm a broken-down something. I'm not sure what I am. You know, it's going back to the R&D. You were referring, Paul, to the low amount of resources that we put into R&D. It is amazing when you look at our overall research budget in this country going up in so many different areas over the last 10 years. It's gone down for energy, despite the role that energy plays, despite the increasing security issues and the price issues and the volatility issues and the oil independence issues. It's actually gone down. If you look at the percent of sales, for example, of pharmacy and software and computer, it's 5 to 15% of gross sales. It's less than 1/5 of 1% for energy. And so we can easily double, triple, quadruple the amount of energy and get some good benefit from that, including perhaps some research in fusion.
Yeah. Well, perhaps that's something on another day we can find some physicists. We come in and talk about that. We're coming down to maybe we have about 2-3 minutes. Just as a kind of a general point, it seems to me that in the way that we have discussed dealing with reducing emissions, particularly the kind of things that come from burning fossil fuels in our cars and in our power plants, that the reluctance that a lot of people have expressed has to do with the economic impact. And essentially they have said if we get really aggressive about emissions and we sign on to these international agreements, that it will be – the bottom line is it will be actually be damaging to the American economy. And other people have said, well, no, that's actually not true, that if we invest in green – energy sources and you know, we move into new technologies, that's actually going to be good for the American economy. Well, how do you come down on this question, particularly how you would respond to those people who would say, well, you know, there's only so aggressive – we can only be so aggressive because it's going to be very hard on the American economy if we're not careful?
Well, let me jump in here first if I could. I don't think that there's any question that dramatically reducing greenhouse gas emissions in the United States are going to be painful for a lot of people because it will mean higher prices for electricity generated by coal and to a lesser extent natural gas, and it will mean higher prices for gasoline, whether this is done through a cap and trade program or any other program. And people out there, your listeners who strongly support a more dramatic U.S. presence on climate change have to be prepared for the fact that some prices will go up. Now, it's also true that there will be business opportunities in energy efficiency or solar, et cetera. But, you know, any kind of major policy initiative like this has redistributive elements, and people who get their electricity currently from nuclear are going to bear a smaller impact of a dramatic climate change action plan than those who get electricity from coal or natural gas. Those who drive relatively little will be harmed much less than those who drive an awful lot. And I think we just have to be aware of this. And we need a concerted effort on the part of whichever new administration we get to educate people as to why those burdens are worth bearing.
The question asked, too, is what is the cost if we don't? It's a higher price, higher disruption, higher impact. And so it really is a matter of weighing the benefits and the costs of the action. And there's a strong financial and economic case to be made for taking action as soon as we can. If we make the number one resource efficiency and productivity, that also is going to generate tremendous savings for our economy and for individuals, and will help pay for the costs of some of the new technologies.
Hmm. And here, I guess I'm not necessarily looking for an endorsement, but as you hear what the two gentlemen who are running for the president say about this, how would you compare or contrast what the two campaigns are saying and about what they would do?
It's fair to say that with either candidate, it's going to be better than the current policies that we've seen in Washington. Of the two candidates, I believe that Senator Obama has the best comprehensive package, the one that is geared more towards the new jobs of the future.
Mm-hmm. I think the important thing to emphasize is that for the first time in a long time, the differences between the candidates on this issue are I would say, negligible. So no matter who it is that gets elected, we will see the United States on a track that I think we need to have been on for some time.
Well, there we must leave it. And just one more time, I will tell you our guests are Paul Portney. He is now Dean of the Eller College of Management at the University of Arizona, Tucson, former President and CEO of Resources for the Future, former Chief Economist for the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and Christine Irvin, President of Christine Irvin Company in Portland. She was the first President, CEO of the Green Building Council, and a former U.S. Assistant Secretary of Energy. The two of them are here visiting the campus to take part in a panel discussion looking at how the country and the world can develop effective policies for dealing with global climate change. This is the Craig Bazzani Lecture in Public Affairs, named for Craig Bazzani, who was a financial administrator here on this campus for a long time. This takes place this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the auditorium of the Beckman Institute for Advanced Study. This is at 400 North Matthews in Urbana. There are a number of sponsors on the campus here. First on the list is the folks at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. And this is open to the public and free, and anyone who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome to stop by there at the auditorium at Beckman. And to the both of you, Christine Irvin, Paul Portney, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
We appreciate it.